About the Roberts case.
Yes, exactly. Brown v. Board and the Roberts case are forever linked.
This is why, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Marshall and I are laying this groundwork for our in-depth discussion of the Brown case.
Earl, it never ceases to amaze me that so many people either don't know about the Roberts case or they simply disregard it.
Thurgood, how did you create, in your incredible and logical legal mind, the bringing together of the Roberts as well as the 1896 Plessy case as you formulated your legal fight in Brown v. Board?
Well, let me tell you. Back in September of 47, I wrote a memo to all of the NAACP branches about Plessy and Separate but Equal. The title was Illegality of Separate School System.
Go on.
September 1947. Some courts, lawyers, and laymen assumed that separate but equal facilities existing in 17 states and the District of Columbia are legal and do not violate the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. This fiction in the law has grown up as a result of certain statements appearing in the decision of the courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. And this, Earl, is where this treatise of mine takes flight, in my humble opinion.
I know. I've read it before. It set the table, Thurgood. It did so perfectly. It's the next section of your memo that has struck me as hitting at the core of the issue of segregation. So please, continue.
An examination of these previous court decisions reveals that the United States Supreme Court has never specifically passed upon the validity or invalidity of segregation statutes in public schools, but has merely restated the separate but equal doctrine first advanced in Plessy v. Ferguson, which involved transportation on trains in the state of Louisiana. The NAACP is convinced that segregation statutes violate the 14th Amendment for several reasons, among which are, one, there is no scientific basis for racial classification by the states. Two, that experience has demonstrated that segregation statutes have brought about discrimination against Negroes and were never intended to provide equal facilities, but rather to set up a system of dual citizenship.
And now, some discussion about the cases that were all part of the Brown case. As you know, there were five cases that were combined to create Brown versus the Board of Education. Now, I have always felt that Briggs versus Elliott from Clarendon County, South Carolina, was the seminal case, and it was the first of the Brown cases to arrive at the U.S. Supreme Court. I was not on the court at that time, and Fred Vinson was the chief, but let me assure you, I followed it very closely. I did have friends back then in Washington.
Earl, as you know, even before Briggs was argued in the courts, it had already caused a major revolution in South Carolina's educational system. Let me read something from one of my memos a year or so later that I wrote for an NAACP meeting. As the case that changed the NAACP's approach to fighting segregation, and as the case responsible for the others to be heard at the same time as one of the Brown cases, and as the one case that provided the most damning evidence of the ills of segregation, Briggs had a key role in ending public school segregation and in laying the groundwork for the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s.
An important voice in Clarendon County was the Reverend Joseph Armstrong J.A. Delane. Besides being a preacher, he was also a teacher and then became a school principal in Clarendon County. He was the person who believed in the quotation by W.B. Harvey, which says, "Injustice will not forever be borne silently." J.A. Delane did not keep silent. He kept the dream alive that the African American children of Clarendon County would receive a quality education and be able to ride to school in buses instead of having to walk 3 or 4 miles each way to school and back home again.
South Carolina's Constitution provided that separate schools shall be provided for children of the white and colored races, and no child of either race shall ever be permitted to attend a school provided for children of the other race. In Clarendon County, a public education was hard to acquire for African Americans. Most schools for African American children were overcrowded, makeshift wooden structures with no indoor plumbing or heat. What little warmth they had was provided by the firewood that was gathered by the students' parents. The farming economy of Clarendon County required that children attend school only when they were not needed in the field. There were vast educational inequities between the black and white races. Educationally, African Americans attending public education facilities outnumbered whites 3-1, but they only received 1/3 of the education budget, and no funds were provided for transportation.
Plessy versus Ferguson, which legalized separate but equal, was alive and well in Clarendon County. And then there was Harry Briggs.
Yes, Harry Briggs. Somerton residents Harry and Eliza Briggs joined with 21 other families to find a school bus suitable for their children. But frequent maintenance led them to ask the local school superintendent, R.M. Elliott, for their own bus. Surmising that the white children rode buses, the white schools in Clarendon County used 33 buses at the time for white students. The Briggs family and many others contended black students could have at least one. Elliott refused, saying black citizens did not pay enough taxes to warrant a bus, and that asking white taxpayers to fund that burden would be unfair.
Then there was the Special Federal District Court, 3-judge panel, that heard the case in late May of 1951. In addition to Judge Waring, who would almost certainly find in favor of the plaintiffs, the other two judges were George Bell Timmerman, a segregationist who would offset Waring's voice, and Judge John Parker, who would hold the deciding vote. Now, Parker was seen as a liberal, but one who wanted slow change. Thurgood, that's when you and your legal team used the testimony of sociologist Kenneth Clark, who argued that segregation caused severe psychological damage to African American children, giving them a feeling of inferiority. Well, the court ruled 2-1 against Briggs and the other parents from Clarendon County. The majority only ruled that the county must make facilities equal.
I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Kenneth Clark. His doll experiment is where they asked black children to choose between a black doll and a white doll. These dolls were the same, except for their skin color, but most thought the white doll was nicer.
Well, the questions asked of those young African-American children really made, in my opinion, the Brown case.
In the experiment, Clark showed black children between the ages of 6 and 9 two dolls, one white and one black, and then asked questions like, "Show me the doll that you like best or that you like to play with. Show me the doll that is the nice doll. Show me the doll that looks bad. Give me the doll that looks like a white child. Give me the doll that looks like a colored child. Give me the doll that looks like you."
In the test that Dr. Clark did that became part of Brown v. Board, he asked 16 black children in 1950 in Clarendon County, South Carolina. Of these, 63% said the white doll was the nice one, the one they wanted to play with.
Earl, you have said many times to me and others that Dr. Clark's doll test really became instrumental in how your court finally came down on Brown. And you also know, Chief, that was exactly what we wanted to have happen. Putting a real story and the effects of discrimination on the face of this case. In fact, Earl, I think we should get into the actual U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown.
Yes, I agree, with one very important stipulation.
And what might that be, Earl?
that you allow me to play the role of the justices by being the one who will pepper you with questions, just as they all did during the re-arguments in the Briggs case back in December of 1953.
That's fine with me.
And the following dialogue comes directly from the oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court from December of 1953. Mr. Chief Justice.
This is case number 101, Harry Briggs, Jr. et al. Against Roger W. Elliott, Chairman et al., members of the Board of Trustees of School District Number 22, Clarendon County, South Carolina et al. Mr. Marshall.
May it please the court. This case is here on direct appeal from the United States District Court of the Eastern District of South Carolina. The specific provision of the South Carolina Code at issue reads as follows. It shall be unlawful for pupils of one race to attend the schools provided by the boards of trustees for persons of another race. The relevant provision of the South Carolina Constitution reads, separate schools shall be provided for children of the white races, and no child of either race shall ever be permitted to attend a school provided for children of the other race. These are the two provisions of the law and the state of South Carolina under attack in this particular case. At the first hearing in the district court, before the trial got underway, counsel for the appellees in open court read a statement in which he admitted that although prior to that time they had decided that the physical facilities of the separate schools were equal, they had concluded finally that they were not equal and admitted in open court that they did not have equality. At that time, however, we as counsel for the appellants made the position clear that the attack was not only being made on the separate but equal basis as to the physical facilities, but the position we were taking was that these statutes were unconstitutional in their enforcement because they not only produced these inevitable inequalities in the physical facilities, but that evidence would be produced by expert witnesses to show that governmentally imposed racial segregation in and of itself was also a denial of equality.
Mr. Marshall, just what is the constitutional issue at hand here?
Mr. Chief Justice, I want to point out that our position is not that we are denied equality in these cases. I think there's been a considerable misunderstanding on that point. We are saying that there is a denial of equal protection of the laws, the legal phraseology of the clause in the 14th Amendment. I say that because I think most of the cases in the past have gone off on the point of whether or not you have substantial equality. It's a type of provision that we think tends to get us in trouble. So pursuing that line, we produced expert witnesses who have surveyed the school situation to show the full extent of the physical inequalities.
But Mr. Marshall, you of course remember that court did not think much of those inequalities. Am I correct, sir?
Mr. Chief Justice, you are correct. However, those witnesses stand in the record as unchallenged as experts in their field. And I think we've arrived at a stage where the courts do give credence to the testimony of people who are expert in their fields.
Now, Mr. Marshall, you also presented in your original arguments before that federal district court the testimony of Dr. Kenneth Clark. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it is.
How did his doll test study demonstrate such injury to the Negro children?
Dr. Clark examined the appellants in this very case and found that they were injured as a result of the segregation. The district court completely disregarded that. I do not know what clearer testimony we could produce in an attack on a specific statute as applied to a specific group of appellants. The only evidence produced by the appellees in this case was one witness who testified as to, in general, the running of the school system and the difference between the rural schools and the consolidated schools, which had no bearing whatsoever on the constitutional question.
Mr. Marshall, where do you place the 14th Amendment in this whole discussion? Some of my colleagues on the court have raised such questions during our deliberations.
Mr. Chief Justice, and I also addressed this response to the other justices in the court. So, here we have the unique situation of an asserted federal right, which has been declared several times by this court to be personal and present, being set aside on the theory that it is a matter for the state legislature to decide, and it's not for this court. And that is directly contrary to every opinion of this court. If the lines are drawn on a natural basis, without regard to race or color, then I think that nobody would have any complaint. For example, the colored child that is over here in this school would not be able to go to that school. The only thing that would be of issue is that whatever lines you set, it shall not be set on race. The children in these cases are guaranteed by the state some 12 years of education in varying degrees. And this idea, if I understand it, to leave it to the states until they work it out, and I think that's the most ingenious argument. You leave it to the states, they say, and then they say that the states haven't done anything about it in 100 years. So for that reason, the court doesn't touch it. The argument of judicial restraint has no application for this case. There is a relationship between federal and state, but there is no corollary or relationship as to the 14th Amendment. The duty of following the 14th Amendment is placed upon the states. The duty of enforcing the 14th Amendment is placed upon this court. We hereby charge them with making the same argument that was made before the Civil War, the same argument that was made during the period between ratification of the 14th Amendment and the Plessy v. Ferguson case in 1896. I got the feeling on hearing the discussion yesterday that when you put a white child in a school with a whole lot of colored children, the child would fall apart or something. Everybody knows that is not true. Those same kids in Virginia and South Carolina, and I've seen them do it, they play in the streets together. They play on their farms together. They go down the road together. They separate to go to school. They come out of school and play ball together. There's some magic to it. You can have them voting together. You can have them not restricted because of law and the houses they live in. You can have them going to the same state university and the same college, but if they go to elementary and high school, the world will fall apart. And it is the exact same argument that has been made to this court over and over again, and we submit that when they charge us with making a legislative argument, it is in truth they who are making the legislative argument.
Mr. Marshall, is there any way whatsoever to take race out of this equation? Is it even possible?
They can't take race out of this case. From the day this case was filed until this moment, nobody has in any form or fashion, despite the fact that I made it clear in my opening argument that I was relying on it, done anything to distinguish this statute from the black codes, which they must admit, because nobody can dispute, say anything anybody wants to say one way or the other, the 14th Amendment was intended to deprive the states of the power to enforce the black codes or anything else like it.
These final words of Mr. Marshall in his closing arguments on Monday, December 7th of 1953 were stunning. His eloquence reverberated throughout the courtroom, and I truly believe throughout our nation. And even today, almost 70 years later, they are still strong, biting, true, and most of all, reflective of how far we have come and how far we must still go. Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, sir. So, whichever way it is done, the only way this court can decide this case in opposition to our position is that there must be some reason which gives the state the right to make a classification that they can make in regard to nothing else in regard to Negroes. And we submit the only way to arrive at this decision is to find that for some reason Negroes are inferior to all other human beings. Nobody. Nobody will stand in this court and urge that. And in order to arrive at the decision they want us to arrive at, there would have to be some recognition of a reason why. Of all the multitudinous groups of people in this country, you have to single out Negroes and give them this separate treatment. It can't be because of slavery in the past, because there are very few groups in this country that haven't had slavery someplace back in the history of their groups. It can't be color, because there are Negroes as white as the drifted snow with blue eyes, and they are just as segregated as the colored man. The only thing that can be an inherent determination that the people who were formerly in slavery, regardless of anything else, shall be kept as near that stage as is possible. And now is the time we submit that this court should make it clear that that is not what our Constitution stands for.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
Before the Chief Justice reads his unanimous U.S. court decision that was made in May 17th of 1954, let me add a few sidebar notes. Although Mr. Warren made sure to say that the opinion had been unanimous, when he first took the bench, the court had been deeply divided. Brown had been argued the previous term before Mr. Warren was appointed, but due to the court's indecision on the matter, it was directed for re-argument. Had the justices voted that term, the vote would have been 5-4 in favor of constitutionality of segregation. The Chief Justice's participation seems to have been catalytic. Irresolution was replaced by unanimity. Finally, Dwight Eisenhower's bid for the presidential nomination in 1952, Mr. Warren clearly stated that he was for broad civil rights programs and the application of one law for all men. Eisenhower was evidently unaware of Earl's statements or chalked them up to campaign rhetoric based on Earl's past record of more conservative decisions. Eisenhower called the appointment the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. However, history has proven Eisenhower wrong. And now, the court's decision. Mr. Chief Justice.
These cases come to us from the states of Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware. They are premised on different facts and different local conditions, but a common legal question justifies their consideration together in this consolidated opinion. In each of the cases, minors of the Negro race have been denied admission to schools attended by white children under laws requiring or permitting segregation according to race. This segregation was alleged to deprive the plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws under the 14th Amendment. In each of these cases, other than the Delaware case, a three-judge federal district court denied relief to the plaintiffs on the so-called separate but equal doctrine announced by this court in Plessy versus Ferguson. Under that doctrine, equality of treatment is accorded when the races are provided substantially equal facilities, even though these facilities be separate. Our decision, therefore, cannot turn on merely a comparison of these tangible factors in the Negro and white schools involved in the previous cases that have come before this court. We must look instead to the effect of segregation itself on public education. In approaching this problem, we cannot turn the clock back to 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted, or even to 1896 when Plessy versus Ferguson was written. We must consider education in the light of its full development and its present place in American life throughout the nation. Only in this way can it be determined if segregation in public schools deprives these plaintiffs of the equal protection of the laws. In these days, it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected in life to succeed if he is denied the opportunity of an education. Such an opportunity, where the state has undertaken to provide it, is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms. We come then to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. To separate these students from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. Segregation of white and colored children in public schools has a detrimental effect upon the colored children. The impact is greater when it has the sanction of the law, for the policy of separating the races is usually interpreted as denoting the inferiority of the Negro group. A sense of inferiority affects the motivation of a child to learn. Segregation, with the sanction of law, therefore, has a tendency to retard the educational and mental development of Negro children and to deprive them of some of the benefits they would receive in a racially integrated school system. Whatever may have been the extent of psychological knowledge at the time of Plessy v. Ferguson, this finding is amply supported by modern authority. Any language in Plessy versus Ferguson contrary to this finding is rejected. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we hold that the plaintiffs and others similarly situated for whom the actions have been brought are, by reason of the segregation complained of, deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. It is so ordered. Thurgood, we've been sitting here having this conversation for almost 45 minutes now, so I think we have to start wrapping things up. Perhaps we could each read something that the other specifically wrote about the Brown decision.
That works for me.
Good.
This is perfect for our conversation today. Right to the point.
Go on.
In your own book of memoirs, first published by Doubleday back in 1977 on page 289 of this 2001 edition. Yes. I think that's the perfect place to start.
Somehow I knew you might go there.
You said this. With courage drawn from this profession of faith in white supremacy by practically every Southern member of Congress, together with oft-repeated congressional speeches, that no nine honest men could possibly have come to the conclusion reached by the High Court in Brown v. Board of Education, excited and racist-minded public officials proposed and enacted every obstacle they could devise to thwart the court's decision.
Thurgood, go on. Go ahead and read the next 19 words, because you know you love this part.
You are so right, Earl. This was aggravated by the fact that no word of support for the decision emanated from the White House.
I still find it amazingly hard to believe that President Eisenhower said and did nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Were you really surprised at this?
All of us on the court expected some resistance from the South, but I doubt if any of us expected as much as we got. I, for one, Thurgood, thought it would be wonderful if, by the time the centennial of the 14th Amendment rolled around back in 1968, the full principle and letter of the law, as we laid out in the Brown decision, could be a reality throughout the land.
Do you really believe that, Earl? Even with the political reality at the time with the president?
Yes, I still believe that much of our racial strife could have been avoided if President Eisenhower had at least observed that our country is dedicated, firmly dedicated, to the principle that all men are created equal.
Amen to that, Earl.
And Thurgood, with Eisenhower's immense popularity, if he had only said, that black children were still being discriminated against long after the adoption of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that the Supreme Court of this great land of ours had now declared it unconstitutional to continue such cruel practices, and that it should be the duty of every good citizen to help rectify more than 80 years of wrongdoing by honoring that decision. If he had said something to that effect, we would have been relieved of many of the racial problems which continue to plague us even today in 2024.
And as we all know, Earl, President Eisenhower only said that the court decision in Brown was a good thing long after he left the White House.
I'll let you wrap things up here, Thurgood. That was our agreement a few moments ago.
Chief, I know you pretty darn well. And I think you have something else on your mind. Am I correct?
Yes, you are. To know how far towards equality of citizenship we have traveled since 1954, we must know from where we started at that time. The Civil War, followed by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And then all of that came crumbling down in 1896 when the Supreme Court took us backwards in time in their horrible decision in Plessy. States could then legally and with force of law separate blacks from whites in public transportation, providing those accommodations were deemed equal. Then Jim Crow and the black codes became the norm all over the South. The doctrine of separation of the races was honored to the nth degree, but the equal part of the equation was totally disregarded.
One nation, indivisible, under God, with liberty and justice for all?
Thurgood, of all the indignities endured by the African Americans, the most macabre one was that blacks could not even lie in peace and rest in the same cemetery as whites. Cemeteries in the South refused to allow the bodies of black soldiers killed in action during the Korean War to be buried in white cemeteries. It took the intervention of the federal courts to overcome this ghoulish and despicable discrimination.
As you said in your own memoirs, oppression solely because of color appears in so many unrelated forms that it is often forgotten that they all, more or less, stem from the doctrine of separate but equal, which was the real meaning of the Supreme Court decision expounded in Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896.
Well, many people despair as to the integrative effectiveness of Brown v. Board of Education because it has not been a complete success. But they fail to recognize the great impact it has had in education and other fields and in its stimulation of Congress to legislate for equal rights. I'm proud of what the court accomplished during my years as Chief Justice.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you for your remarkable and steadfast service to the High Court and to our nation.
Thank you, Thurgood.
Let me close our proceedings here tonight by saying this. Chief Justice Warren has always been a man who selects his words carefully, or should I say, judiciously. You know, he's always been a very difficult person to follow after he's made his points clearly and effectively.
Thurgood, let me ask you a similar question to the one you asked me earlier tonight.
Which is?
Was the Brown case the most important one in which you were involved?
Earl, sometimes I think that I and probably other people overestimate the importance of the Brown case. Certainly, its impact on disassembling separate but equal foundation laid in a place with Plessy was huge. And its long-term influence on the idea that all children deserve a free and appropriate public education, which put into place integrated schools, as well as the basis for special education, as we know it today, was monumental.
And it was only the beginning. Racial and social inequality still exist in our country. The quest for equality for members of LGBT community, for immigrants who come to this country, and for any group of people who are in their own unique way different, still continues.
Chief, as we approach the 70th anniversary of the Brown decision, there are still many stories to tell about this case and the many people who played a part in making it come alive. As Juan Williams said in his 1998 book about me, subtitled American Revolutionary, before an entire generation is gone, there are still many people who want to share their role in the great drama of the Brown case. They have stories to tell, stories that they want in the history books.
You are correct. All of their stories vary in the details, but they all circle, as Juan Williams said, in that one critical moment in American history, like planets orbiting the sun, the momentous ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education. For it was Brown that raised the possibility of integration becoming a reality in their minds, whether they were for it or against it.
For it was Brown, in that single ruling back in 1954, that put the power of the federal government's judges, FBI agents, and even the U.S. military forces on the side of equal rights for all. It is Brown that makes segregation not only immoral, but a crime in this great nation of ours. Not just for this generation, but for all generations, past, present, and future.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. You were a true giant whose commitment to equality only expanded during your years of service, and you remain true to the values of freedom and equality despite the erosion of the liberal majority on the court that you helped sustain.
Mr. Chief Justice, you were always someone who could put a string of words together that were remarkable and stunning. One of my favorites was always this: Americans have one of the greatest legal systems, but not a monopoly on a sense of justice, which is universal. Nor have we a permanent copyright on the means of securing justice, for it is the spirit and not the form of law that keeps justice alive. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
And this has been Brown, Thurgood Marshall, and Earl Warren, a conversation. A few words about this play. The words separate but equal and with all deliberate speed can all be applied to the 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision on May 17th of 1954. In this landmark decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. And just as a side note, the award-winning playwrights, myself and the late Michael Ulstrup, tackle another important social issue in a play that we're currently working on. This play, Brown, was first performed as a full theatrical stage production in April 2014 at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as part of a national symposium celebrating then the 60th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. This world premiere was introduced by Cheryl Brown Henderson, and you heard her in an interview that I just did previously to this program on education matters. Cheryl, the daughter of the late Reverend Oliver L. Brown, after whom this landmark court case is named. In the words of Cheryl Brown Henderson, "When it comes to this production about the Brown case, this play is set in present day and gives us a glimpse into what Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren might be talking about today as they reminisce about the Brown case and what led up to it and where we go from here." This has been Brown, Thurgood Marshall and Earl Warren, a conversation, written by the late Michael Ulstrup and myself, Steve Brown. It starred Cameron Spencer as Thurgood Marshall and Stephen Dundas as Earl Warren. As always, support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Brown Ulstrup Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem, Wisconsin, and also the Kenosha Public Library System and those here at the Southwest Neighborhood Library. For the WGTD Radio Theater and the 91.1 Players, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening. This is WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.